Hello, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. My name is Tracy Morgan, your host, and I'm very pleased to have with us today an author who we have been trying to find a time to do this interview, we finally have done it, although we're concerned about the a little bit of static in the background, but we decided to go ahead. We're speaking between New York and Israel. You're in Tel Aviv, Aner?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and so today we have, and help me out with the pronunciation, should I say Aner Govrin?
Yeah, or, that's perfect.
Okay, good. I have a lot of Israeli friends in New York. I've developed the ear. And we're going to be speaking with him about his 2016 Routledge publication entitled Conservative and Radical Perspectives on Psychoanalytic Knowledge, The Fascinated and the Disenchanted. I enjoyed this book very much, and I think that there's a lot of people are going to want to sort of read it who are interested in sociology of knowledge and sort of how has psychoanalysis found itself in the position it's currently in. Very few people look at our field in the way in which I think you do in this book. So we'll begin with the usual question that we ask every author, which is what motivated you or drove you or however you want to put it to write this book?
Well, you know, I've always been a fascinated analyst.
Yes.
And I've always been a troubled analyst, too. Mm-hmm. That means I was very fascinated by the theories I learned at the 90s when I started my learning at the MA at Tel Aviv University. Mm-hmm. And it was a period when the psychodynamic approach was dominated by the object relation theory. Mm-hmm. And it fascinated me, the texts, the theories, the profound thinking of the human psyche, how mm-hmm. they understand and how did they convey, the unconscious and what we saw in our patients. Mm-hmm. And it explained a lot of things that were, without that, it was so confusing to understand, and it was so, tantalizing to give a profound meaning to our patients, but not only to our patients, but also to myself, to my friends, to my family. You know, we began to speak in psychoanalytic language. Animal character and projection, and this friend has a grandiose self, and this friend is this other friend is splitting, and we became I became immersed like mm-hmm. all of my other colleagues in the language, mm-hmm. and I think that's what happens to most people that are starting to learn the psychoanalytic language and the psychoanalytic theory, and I became fascinated by that. And also, I started my analytic training, so fascination became, a huge thing in my life, the love for psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I was also troubled by what I saw in the psychoanalytic community. I saw that people are not critical about the theories. They sort of take them for granted. They are very loyal to the theories. Many people learn one theories for their entire professional life. And so I was sort of, troubled by that. And I didn't want to be totally immersed and to lose my free thought. So I guess I became more both fascinated and troubled. And I wanted to understand the deep reasons for fascinations and for being troubled inside the community. So I also wanted to understand why psychoanalysis is so successful. Mm-hmm. I know it sounds strange because many people think that it's dying, but I really don't think so. I think it's a successful discipline.
You make a very bold statement, actually, early, I think early in the book, that psychoanalysis is, quote, one of the most successful intellectual enterprises in the history of Western thought. Mm-hmm. I had a moment when I read that. I thought, I don't know that I've ever read anyone else who has just put, you know, sort of just said that. And I was like, you know, I would have to agree. Yeah, but nevertheless, the field does remain, on the one hand, under siege, and on the other hand, as you say, it continues to thrive.
Yes, well, I know it sounds strange because, you know, most people don't identify psychoanalysis with success.
It's called the impossible profession, right?
That's right. It's like that. The heyday is sort of over when it's not today. But
yeah.
I think you should judge a discipline if it's successful or not, not on its heyday, not when it's fashionable to believe in it, mm-hmm. but on the contrary, when, you know, when people when it has difficulties, when it is in a crisis. Now, if you look at other disciplines at the time when psychoanalysis was evolved, many of them just vanished. They don't exist today. So I ask myself, why is it so well? How did it survive? What is the key to understand its strength? And the main thesis of the book is that its strength is because it has two kinds of communities. Mm-hmm. There are the fascinated community, which is those people, those communities, those groups that believe in one theory, like Klein theory or Bion theory or mm-hmm. Freud or ego psychology or Lacan mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. self-psychology. And they are very loyal to their theory, and they work their entire professional life with that one theory, although some of them, you know, combine other theories too. Mm-hmm. And beside them, there are also the troubled communities. These are groups and people that are not satisfied with the state of knowledge, and they want to change that knowledge. And they continually update the theory and make it improve the theory, and are very creative and think of new techniques and new conceptualizations. And these two mm-hmm. communities, the fascinated community and the troubled communities, although there is a lot of tension between them and they often do not like each other, they really help sustain the psychoanalytic knowledge and the psychoanalytic discipline. And mm-hmm. they evolve it, they develop it, they dedicate their entire life to its elaboration. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of the main reasons that psychoanalysis is still thriving today.
Mm-hmm. Because of the tension between the two communities? Is that your idea? That,
exactly.
That the tension is generative?
Exactly. One community is very loyal to the main theory, resist to change, and but are not static. You know, they keep developing the theory in their own original format. Like if you mm-hmm. you see the Kleinian theory or the self-psychologist, mm-hmm. The self-psychology today is much is richer and much more varied than at times of Coate, and you can say mm-hmm. the same thing about the Kleinian theory and mm-hmm. and every Klein and every psychoanalytic school. But alongside mm-hmm. these communities are troubled communities which update the theory and take it to new path, develop it.
Could you name for the listeners, I mean, when you talk about the troubled communities, in the book you talk about scientifically troubled, meaning those analysts who say, you know, how come we're not doing more research to prove, you know, that what we do is, you know, has a scientific basis. So they're scientifically troubled, and there are philosophically troubled communities. Can you give us some names of people or you know, groups that you would associate with those that are troubled, so that the audience gets a better sense?
Yes, of course. There are three kinds of troubled communities that are active in the psychoanalytic world. First of all, and the most important, is the new psychoanalytic schools. So every psychoanalytic school is first a troubled community. Like Klein was a troubled analyst. She was not satisfied with the Freudian theory. So she invented and developed a new kind of theory, the Klein theory. So every psychoanalytic school starts as a troubled community, and then after a while, the founder and the followers became a fascinated community,
and they
are, you know, fixated on their solutions and on their technique. That's one kind of troubled community. There are two other troubled communities, the scientifically troubled communities. You can see that in analysts or psychodynamic therapists that are mostly work in universities and make research, and they strongly believe that the future of psychoanalysis is in empirical research. And they're doing a very important job in trying to verify the psychoanalytic theory. And they also, this is the group that also make efficient, you know, the how efficient is the psychoanalytic technique and psychodynamic therapist. And they're sort of our bridge to academic psychology. There are also two important scientifically troubled communities, with the infant research, people like Daniel Stern and B.B. and Lachman and Lou Sander, which they think is you have to verify what happens between infants and their mothers, not just in theory and not just in the clinical encounter, but also in observe these interactions physically and concretely. And there is also the neuropsychoanalysis, which is also a very important psychoanalytic community. And the third troubled community is the philosophically, culturally troubled community, which the main group here is the relational approach, which with all the, you know, the revolution it made in within psychoanalysis.
I wanted to ask you, thank you for laying that out so clearly. You make an argument, amongst the many arguments you make in the book, but you make an argument that perhaps postmodern thinking might not keep the field alive and kicking, so to speak, that there might be a relationship between the postmodern critique largely coming out of the relational school or utilizing sort of postmodern theory about, you know, subjectivity, intersubjectivity, thirdness, the critique of truth, et cetera, that might impact our field and make it less generative. I think that's a very interesting and key argument. Could you talk more about that?
Well, that's a great question, and I love to talk about. Do we have 2 or 3 hours?
We have, you know, I mean, do you want me to extend the session?
Well, I'll try to make it as brief as I can.
Okay.
Well, the thesis is that the most prolific period of time of psychoanalysis was not today, was not contemporary psychoanalysis, but the modern era. The founders of the schools, like Winnicott, Cote, Bion, and Freud, of course, and Klein, they were not interested in epistemology. They were not interested in philosophy. They were not interested in truth questions. They really thought that they know the truth, that they really discovered the truth. They thought that they can really know what happened, what is going on in the mind of an infant 3 weeks old or 6 months old. And they didn't think that what their theory is a narrative or an option. They thought it is the truth itself. Mm-hmm. Now, we are sort of lucky that they were not interested in philosophy, because if they knew how difficult it is and how complicated it is, almost impossible to claim truth, that you really know what is going on in the mind of a infant 3 weeks old, I think they wouldn't have the balls and they wouldn't dare to create such rich theories. So we are lucky that they didn't know it. We are lucky that they were not interested in philosophy. They were not, certainly were not postmodernist. They just wanted to share their knowledge with us, and they really thought that they discovered a fantastic and marvelous truth about the human infant, about psychopathology, about transference. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, I think it's impossible, because no one has, no one dares to say that he really can know what is going on in the mind of an infant. And no one can say that, no one dares to say that he really knows what is the human psyche in all its richness.
Right.
So that's a problem today, because in the postmodern era, we don't like monolithic truth. We don't like grand theories anymore. And although the postmodern are right, they have a good case here that truth is, you know, is pluralistic and is you really cannot know the truth. What they did was they didn't intend to do it, but the result was that we don't have any grand theories anymore. The last grand theories, grand narrative, was self-psychology, and that was at the 80s. Now we have only local truth, small truth. Mm-hmm. Interesting, though, but only local and small.
You actually call this in the book, this is the most impoverished period, mm-hmm. I think you mean for theory, in the history of psychoanalysis, and that if we were to put together a dictionary, I think it is, or a book of you know, sort of new truths derived from the impact of postmodernism, I think you say it would be a very thin volume, very thin book.
Yes, yes.
I mean, it's pretty funny. I laughed when I read that. I was like, whoa. I had never had that thought, but I was like, huh. Because, of course, in many ways, the relational tradition, you know, out of which your book is published from Rutledge, and I'm always in touch with Rutledge and the series that Lou Aaron, works on editing, is filled. I mean, the relational school is writing a lot. You know, they're really publishing a lot. But your argument is that if we were to put certain new ideas, sort of derived from the postmodern critique, we wouldn't have very much to read.
And right, it's a strange, they are publishing.
It's very strange because most of the books I get are from the relationals. You know, mm-hmm. like nobody else is publishing. You know, not quite, but like, yeah, comparatively.
They are doing a great job. They are publishing a lot. I myself am a relational analyst, and I am a member of the IARPP.
Oh, you are.
Yes, but the problem is that. Look at these wonderful, fantastic dictionaries of the Kleinian thought, or LaPlanche and Pontelli, the Dictionary of Psychoanalysis, and the Winnicott Dictionary.
Right.
They're all...
Hinshelwood. Yeah.
Yes, and Hinshelwood, right, the Kleinian theory. And these are all very rich, and there are many concepts there. Now, So in order to say that there is a psychic phenomenon, these are all books about psychic phenomenon, dictionaries about psychic phenomenon, you have to have a truth theory. You have to think that there is something that exists that is true. And it's not pluralistic, it's not a metaphor, it's not a narrative, it is there.
Well, remember the moment when, I mean, I was not trained as a Kleinian, but I remember, certainly have read a lot of Klein, and having to wrap my mind around the idea that the infant is born with an ego. What? That took me like 2 years, you know, but that's like, if you don't accept that as a truth, nothing holds together. You know what I mean? In following her theory. So there are certain, you know, I mean, I'm trained as a modern analyst. And so Spotnitz has the idea that schizophrenia is caused, I mean, this is a shorthand, but by attacking the self rather than external objects depletes the ego. I mean, you either accept that as real and everything else works from there, or you're lost.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly. So, yeah. I once asked a Kleinian, a devoted Kleinian, listen, do you really think that the infant attacks his mother when he's 3 weeks or 1 month old? Does he really, has a fantasy of biting her? Or do you just use it as sort of a metaphor to understand your adult patients? And he said, "No, this really happens. This is really the human infant. That's how he behaves. So for them, it's not a metaphor. It's true. That's what happens out there in the world.
Right.
And so relational don't have this concept of things that really happen in the world, because everything is intersubjective, and everything is, you know, construed
Rashomon.
Exactly. So we lost the very creative power, a very creative source in psychoanalytic, you know, building a theory. We took the force of it, but you know, it's naive to think that we really can go back to that period of time of the modernist and believe in that believe that it's true again.
Right. I mean, but you're arguing, I think, in the book for something that there's a feminist philosopher, a queer critical thinker named Diana Fuss, and she has, uses this phrase, strategic essentialism. I think it's her phrase. I read it so long ago, but it stayed with me, like this, to use essence strategically. And I thought this book is in praise of a little bit, your book is in praise of the notion of, you know, of go for some essence, go for some truth, and let's see what evolves and can grow out of, a little essentialism. However, you know, the postmodern critique within psychoanalysis, I was thinking this as I read the book, I was like, it's kind of like the superego. Like the critique is now like, oh, that's binary thinking. Stop it. I mean, I will tell you, I have sat in places where I've listened to people who say like, but that's a binary, you know, construction of thought and blah, blah. And I'm like, oh my. So it's sort of like the new watchdog. Mm-hmm. Like when people get too close to, saying something that is more essentialist. And in fact, did you read Galit Atlas's, this is, you know, your Israeli-American colleague, who wrote The Enigma of Desire? Uh-huh. She attempts to write about an essential truth of the body and pregnancy. And I loved the book for that, because I said, who in this school comes out and says anything that has a quote-unquote bedrock? Anyway, and her book created great waves, I think, within the relational thinking. But it's a book that really puts forth an essentialist idea. So
exactly,
good for her,
Galit does it, and she does it in a very eloquent way, and I was really impressed by it. And Galit is relational, and many relational have these, you know, sort of mini theories, mm-hmm. like you can take Donnell Stern with the unformulated experience, which is, you know, a beautiful conceptualization and a very helpful one. But these are small truth, mini truth, you know. They are not compared, we cannot compare them to the grand theories like a big jigsaw of Winnicott or of Klein, that everything has to do with everything. You know, that's mm-hmm. that's a big narrative. In those days, in the modern era, or even in within fascinated analysts today, if you ask an analyst, tell me, please, how do you think the infant develops? If he tells you that, if he answers this question, you have a very good idea of how that analyst works, what is his technique, and how does, what is his transference perception, how does he views his the transference, you know, because everything is connected to everything. While nowadays you take from here and you take from there. So I do not want to downsize the huge contribution of the relational approach. You know, the fascinated school are actually the super ego, which when their relational approach was more, you know, much more, you know, with humor, and it didn't take itself so seriously. And you know, it was not so pompous as the classical analyst. And it was democratic and pluralistic. And, we had to do that revolution. There was no way. But it came with a price. And that's what I'm talking about in my book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you also make an argument about the fascinated communities, that they all have certain qualities. One, though, that's very prominent is a sort of charismatic leader. And as I read through the book, I was like, well, but, I mean, had Stephen Mitchell lived, don't you think he would have been a charismatic leader? I was curious about your argument, because it seemed that, you know, that they're a philosophically troubled community, but he was charismatic. I mean, the way, I've never met him, but I know people who speak about him, you could feel he had a charismatic impact, no? Mm-hmm.
I met Steve, and he was very charismatic, and he was a natural leader, and he also was a very nice and friendly person, and he helped to found my institute, Tel Aviv Institute for Psychoanalysis. Uh-huh. Yes, he gave us big help, but Steve did not want to be a founder of a school. He really said that, you know. So it's not enough to be charismatic. You have to be first charismatic, but you have to be a founder of a school which you think that a theory of that school is a true theory. And Steve never meant to do that. And in fact, he really helped us in that disillusionment that I'm talking about, of the fascination of psychoanalytic school. So he never meant to be a founder of a school. That was not his intention.
It's interesting. I actually didn't know that, but I guess following your argument, it does make sense. You also make a interesting comment that all of the fascinated schools hold to a quote unquote one person psychology sort of model. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, that's interesting. That seems quite true, but can you help us to understand why that has been the case? And for listeners who might not know the one person versus the two person model, what we're talking about is, you know, are there two subjectivities in the room, or is there the analyst, you know, thinking about what the patient is bringing, and you know, as if the transference is pure and not related to the analyst counter transference, it's subjective. Mm-hmm. So, but why are the fascinated communities? Why do they tend toward a one person psychological model?
Well,
if you know,
well, yes. One person, if you think that a fascinated school, first of all, it think that the theory is true, it corresponds with reality. Mm-hmm. So it's not really intersubjective, right? It's not really relational. Right. It's just exist out there in the world. And this is a very one-person psychology vision. So many of these schools think that the the main thing, the main aim of psychoanalysis is to reveal the unconscious fantasies of the patient. And this is a very one-person mm-hmm. psychology ideology, because you think that it's the unconscious is out there to be revealed, mm-hmm. whereas in a two-person psychology, the both analyst and patient construe what the meaning of the analyst's mind and of the patient's mind. So it's really cannot be part of that fascinated theory. Yeah, you're fascinated mm-hmm. by the theory. Well, whereas in two-person psychology, you're really fascinated by the process of what's happened, what can happen between analyst and patient.
I mean, what you also I have all these quotes that I was like, wow, they're just these statements that were so crystalline and surprising at the same time. The unconscious is a product of a one-person approach. Now, I've wondered for a long time, and I've asked questions like, so, you know, whither goeth the unconscious, you know, in, you know, like unformulated experience, or whither goeth, you know, in, you know, thinking through, you know, friends who are, you know, interpersonalists, where is the, you know, the unconscious? And you actually say it's the product of a one-person approach. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some people would say, well, no unconscious, no psychoanalysis, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you hear that. What is that and a lot of people will say that. They'll say, well, if you're not working with the unconscious, then you're not, you know, you're not doing analytic work. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that, I'm sure you've heard that. I mean, what's your reply to that?
Well, I think there's a really an inherent contradiction between contemporary psychoanalysis and the classical idea of the unconscious, mm-hmm. because the unconscious is something that is not known to the patient,
right?
But it has to be known in therapy, and how can it be known in therapy when it is not known to the patient? So, you know, someone has to know that, and the postmodern and contemporary psychoanalysis, they don't want to to perceive the analyst as one who has monopoly over the unconscious of the patient. But mm-hmm. then someone has to know that, and who would that person be?
Right. And who would that person be?
And so I think there is a lot of, you know, there is sort of a neglect, even intentional neglect in relational view about the unconscious, you know, because, or there is something that they really did not make their mind up about that. It's interesting that if we take the intersubjective theory of Stolarow and yes. Atwood and mm-hmm. and Donna Orange here, there you see a very interesting thing, because they have a very detailed description of the unconscious with many types of unconscious.
Yes,
I think that was a reply on Coates' critique that Coates did not emphasize enough the unconscious, so they sort of, you know, answered mm-hmm. and made a very detailed approach. But I think it's also the contradiction is still there inherent, because how can there be an unconscious in an intersubjective milieu, an intersubjective encounter? Someone has to mm-hmm. know that unconscious, or someone has to have the tools to get to there. So it's really, we're really going back to one-person psychology. So the unconscious is basically a one-person psychology idea.
Huh. Well, do you think that, this is a little bit off topic, it's not just particular to your book, but I just had this thought. So the role that thirdness plays, I'm going to be interviewing Jessica Benjamin shortly, and I'm thinking, rereading a lot of her writings, and I'm like, okay, so thirdness is this unconscious that the analyst and patient have together. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wonder if you think, does it serve to sort of as a, not a stand-in, I don't mean it's substitutive, but sort of in the same place that in a one-person psychology, the unconscious has, is the thirdness?
Yes, yes, I think you're right. I think it's one of the ideas that try to solve that gap that I'm talking about between contemporary psychoanalysis. It's still psychoanalysis, which means that the unconscious must be something that is, you know, is still vital and important, but they don't want to retreat to classical psychoanalysis. And the third is sort of, you know, a partial solution for that problem. I think you're right.
Yeah, it feels that way when it's like, it's not mine. It's not yours. It's not mine. It's ours. Right. But it's still something that is ineffable, you know, has an ineffable, erratic, you know, kind of a, you know, Benjaminian, almost like some sort of a quality to it. When reading Ogden and Ben, and when I say Benjaminian, I mean Walter. But anyway, speaking of Jessica Benjamin, another Benjaminian, you know, kind of quality. It's just, it's interesting. I believe in thirdness. I totally get it. I'm still sort of more of a fascinated one person, but you know, but I guess I'm always looking for places where we're saying something similar or to find shared ground. That seems, you know, for my own reasons, that's important to me. Part of why we do New Books in Psychoanalysis is, you know, to sort of open communication amongst people who don't all think the same thing, you know what I mean? And we don't. You know, what I was thinking in reading this book that you know, art that many in the field, aside from like an Eric Kandel who got so upset he left, right? Left the field, but there is a lot of hostility, and I have this hostility in myself too, toward data. And I wanted to ask you if you had thoughts, like what if we got against data? Will data just get rid of all the different fascinated communities? I mean, are we at risk of being perishing if we go after quote unquote data? Why do we hate it?
Well,
help me.
Well, we hate it because analysts find it. First of all, analysts do not take any interest in empirical research. And you know, they're just not interested. By the way, not just analysts, but many psychotherapists from many other schools are not interested in empirical research. It has many reasons, but one of the chapter of the book really, you know, concerned that and try to understand that phenomenon. Why are we not interested in empirical research? Why are we not interested in other disciplines or other psychotherapies?
Totally, yeah. Right. I mean, your argument about Kohut and Carl Rogers, I was like, what? I've always thought that. I was always like, he's a Rogerian, but without, you know, so we also don't often leave a good footnote trail, you know, or our footnotes aren't as complete as they might be, which is interesting. We don't know, we don't cite, you know, and it's not so much plagiarism, I don't think, but I wonder about it. I'm like, how come we get away with that? Other disciplines, I don't think you get away with that, you know?
Well, these are two very important questions that I deal with. First of all, the fascinated community centers around one theory or one or two theory, like an analyst can combine between Winnicott and Coate, or be just Kleinian, or be Kleinian and Bionian. It doesn't really matter. Right. What matters is that the theory really is the source of a rich and complex narrative, an overarching narrative. And this narrative is very rich and is very fulfilling. It answers many of the questions, many of the puzzling questions about the patients. And it's sort of, the analyst sort of gets stuck in his narrative. And the narrative is highly detailed. It offers many options for giving meaning to clinical material. It's very satisfactory to use it. And so the analyst, there is no hunger.
Feels so good.
Right. And there is no hunger for thing that is outside that narrative, that are external to the narrative. So
That's right.
A fascinated analyst can really live his entire professional lifetime without feeling even once that he's in need of anything other than the psychoanalytic formulation, which was he's so familiar with.
It's like never having to eat food that you don't like, you know. It's like you open up the menu and it's always everything that you want is in there, you know. It's like never a calf's liver or something that you don't like. It's always like a perfect menu, and the patient is going to fit within you know, a certain theoretical menu. And there is satisfaction. I mean, you can be very satiated. Yeah. You know, it really is, it can feel nourishing. Like, look, I found it.
Right. And I'm not just saying that to mock the analyst, because the narratives themselves, the theories themselves are very rich, very profound, and they produce a lot of meaning. And another thing that I must mention is that in the book I'm saying that this is not really very different from what happens in science, because scientists also have their own scientific theory they are loyal to, they adhere to, and they don't drop the scientific theory just because research saw contradicting results. You know, all the post-positivist philosophers of science like Larry Loudon or Kuhn or Lakatos, they show us that scientists are very indoctrinated to their theories. Mm-hmm. And it's a good thing, because if you're not indoctrinated to a theory, you will not develop it. You will not become, you know, very creative within that frame of theory. So there is really a good thing about loyalty, devotion, and even indoctrination. And my whole book is really a defense of the fascinated communities, why they are important for us, why fascination is important at all. Because you cannot develop a new theory. You cannot raise a child. You know, you cannot open a new business without fascination.
That's right. That's right. It's nothing happens without fascination.
Right.
And yet there's, go ahead.
The danger is that fascination will be, will just act alone. So beside the fascination communities, there must be troubled communities, and this combination is the best thing for a discipline to survive and to thrive.
Well, you know, living here in the United States, where we're thinking a lot about fascism and fascination, you know, to break up. I mean, fascism is about fascination. I mean, it's really, and I think that when people get troubled by, you know, sort of monolithic ideas, you know, and they become troubled and they try to break it up and loosen the grip. And certainly within, you know, the short history of psychoanalysis, I mean, we act this out and repeat this again and again. But your idea is that, you know, that's okay. Like, that's how it goes, you know, and that out of that, can be a fertile process, as long as it continues as a process. And because we do have a lot of splitting, right? I mean, you know, analysts who haven't talked to each other in 30 years, you know, I meet them all the time, you know. Oh yeah, I used to know him, but he became a this and I don't believe that, you know. How to sort of resolve the splits, but without becoming boring and you know, having nothing new to say. I mean, your book is an argument. It argues that we need the fascination. We have to keep it afloat.
Right. Although I completely agree with what you said, that it's also very dangerous. It can lead to fascism, totalitarian, state of mind. And we know how the psychoanalytic institutes were once handled with the very, they were very authoritarian and they were very even corrupted. You know, if you read the history of books about their history of the psychoanalytic institutes, it's sad, you know, it's really sad. But today I think that the fascinated communities are really weakened. They are weak, much more weaker than they once were. because postmodernism is very on a high level. So fascinated communities, they know that it's not democratic, and they know that it's not the right thing to say that, you know, I believe that it's true. So they really pay a lip service and they say how they're, you know, pluralistic and they're open-minded. But in, I think inside their heart, many analysts still believe in the correspondent theory of truth and in the monolithic truth. But the fact that they are much more weak than they were, I think it's a good thing for us today. So there is these analysts who will still continue to think that what they think is true, and we want them to think so because that's what will make them creative. And beside them, along them, there will be the troubled analysts. And this is a very good combination, as I write in my book.
Absolutely. And, you know, I was thinking about the institute that I graduated from, which I think has been a fascinated community, which is run now by Mimi Kroll. And she's been very influenced by very different psychoanalytic thinkers, and in fact has changed. So we always had a final paper, which was a research paper. The idea at the institute was that psychoanalysis is a model of research. And that the psychoanalytic method is a research method in and of itself. So we did these research papers. But recently, you know, she's been like, you know, let's let students write for their final papers and see and sort of see more where they go. Because as you write in the end of the book, like the institutes have to take a different position in order to generate new and compelling knowledge. You know, and I think that that's really an important point, like actually risking losing everything that you've ever believed in to allow something new to grow, is certainly not an easy thing, for anyone to do, especially somebody who heads an institute, you know, to allow that room. So, your argument is, you know, that the troubled communities have shaken things up enough that people in the fascinated institutes are, I think, giving candidates a little bit more breathing room, you know, for sure. We have a little bit more time. I really sense a connection between you and John Mills. I was not surprised, but interested to hear that you two are working on a publication or on a text. Is that right?
Yes.
Together? Yeah. Because I thought you and John both, in your sort of thinking through the good parts and the more perilous parts of the postmodern impact. Do you care to just let us know what it is that you're working on next?
Yes, sure. I met John through his critique of the relational approach, and he's a troubled analyst and a very eloquent one. And I think his contribution in the philosophy of psychoanalysis is enormous. Is very, very important.
Yeah.
And now what we're doing is we are editing together a book about innovations in psychoanalysis. We want to show that psychoanalysis is very updated and innovative and creative. And we asked authors from various disciplines to contribute to this book and to show what in their specific school, like the Kleinian school and neuropsychoanalysis and self-psychology, what is the most innovating contribution to that, to the theory, what happened in recent years to show that psychoanalysis is really, you know, relevant today, and that people are still developing it. It's not that they are just working on the past or on classical accounts. And I think I think the book will show that.
It seems like it must be very satisfying, because it seems that in fact that book that you're working on would answer or sort of provide a, you know, the like slake your thirst. I mean, you seem to be hungry in your argument for, you know, sort of showing a sort of a third position, like that, you know, we're within psychoanalysis, what's new under the sun? I often feel, and often other hosts will say in New Books in Psychoanalysis, there are no new ideas in psychoanalysis. And there is often that feeling. So I think that it's, you know, this book that you're putting together, I don't know when you guys are going to be done with it, but will be very useful, a compendium, mm-hmm. you know, to see what is new, you know, in the different schools. So I imagine it's sort of like a, you know, a bomb in Gilead, like a gift, you know, after this book to move to that for you.
Yes. Well, I think as psychoanalysis is despite what people think, is going a constant change, and it's one of its great strengths, and that's because of these troubled communities and troubled analysts. And I also want to mention that, and one of the chapters of the book is dedicated to it, that within the fascinated communities, there are also a lot of change that is going on. Because these fascinated mm-hmm. communities, you know, develop their own theory. And, you know, they are tense. They have a tension between being loyal to the original formulations and being new. And they do not want to lose the contact with the original founder. So they always, you know, say and describe and give him credit for what they're doing. Like if you take Betty Joseph, for example.
Betty Joseph, yes. Perfect example.
Yes,
yeah.
But there is a lot of change that is going on within psychoanalysis. And it's one of the strengths of psychoanalysis that it can be updated and relevant to the world as it is today. When the world was with its scientific ethos, when it's very scientific, so psychoanalysis was scientific. When the world was postmodern, mm-hmm. psychoanalysis became postmodern. Now the world is more religion and more spiritual, and we have this branch of within psychoanalysis that it's more religious and more spiritual. So it mm-hmm. sort of, you know, can update and adapt itself to the worldviews and what's going on, and to be very relevant.
And to add to that, though, I mean, psychoanalysis is certainly porous in that way, can absorb changes in the culture and in the ethos. But on the other hand, we always say, oh, psychoanalysis we experience ourselves as imperiled, as a field in peril. How many times have people said, it's over, Freud is dead, psychoanalysis is dead, but they can't seem to kill it. But what role, whoever they are, you know, and whoever they are coming from the outside or even, you know, from the inside, what is the role of peril? I mean, have you thought about the role of like of peril for psychoanalysis and the fear of dying or being killed off?
Well, it was buried so many times, you know, like mm-hmm. but you know, it has this I remember seeing in the New York Times, when was it, at the Times, I think, at the 80s, is Freud dead, you know?
Oh yeah.
And people keep saying that it's dead. And but, you know, I read a very very interesting survey about more than 2,000 therapists in North America that mm-hmm. Most of them are, I think, two-thirds are using psychoanalytic ideas and use psychoanalytic techniques to help their patients. They integrate mm-hmm. them with CBT and other methods, but it's still living and kicking, and it's still there, and it's still very very dominant, although it's not as dominant as it was before at the 40s and 50s. But I think it's still dominant. But you know, the fear of dying was a fear that was from the first day of psychoanalysis. The fixation that are we just loyal to Freud, or do we have something new to say? It mm-hmm. was it was it really preoccupied the analyst throughout the, the entire life of the discipline.
Yes, absolutely. And it's funny because doesn't Lowald say something about, you know, in his paper on the resolution of the Oedipal, that you have to be willing at some level to kill your parents in order to create a new life, you know. But but analysts, you know, we're very frightened to sort of, we want to keep connected. We're scared of being excommunicated, you know. We need our institutes, you know, in order to be a part of a community. I mean, this work is isolating, you know, and it's not necessarily good for you, you know, to be outside of a community when you're doing your work. But it's how to stay connected and yet do something new and not be thrown out as a result. I mean, it's really, it's a dilemma in between parents and children, and it's a dilemma between sort of senior analysts and, you know, the up and coming generation. I think we have to stop for today, but before we do, is there anything else that we didn't cover that you wanted to let the audience know about your book?
Well, I think what the book is about, and that's what I want people to stay with, is the idea that we should make psychoanalysis contemporary and new and relevant, but the past is also very important. The tradition is also very important. And only the combination, only if we can, you know, combine these two and cherish the past and cherish the tradition without, you know, being, without putting it to, without making it ridiculous. And, and we can sort of, you know, accept there are different people who are doing different things, and there are people that are really, believing in that their theories are true, and they also have a place, and they are very important. And beside that, there should be people that should critique these groups and communities and make new things and say that it's that we have to have new solutions. This thing that is very tense and very hostile sometimes to each other is a very precious thing for us, for our discipline.
Yes, a good fight.
Right, exactly.
a good fight, and then you have sex afterwards, and you move on. You know, so nothing like makeup sex. You know, so yeah, so that's what we're aiming for in psychoanalysis: keeping sexuality in psychoanalysis, as Green Green was urging us to do. Okay, so listeners, we're going to sign off now. The next interview I'm going to do will be with Jessica Benjamin and her new book, which I don't have the title, but it's on recognition theory. And then Frederick Cruz, who doesn't like Freud very much, but I'm still looking forward to talking with him and seeing what he has to say. He's been writing about Freud for years. So until then, I want to thank Aner for visiting with us. We will look forward to talking to you and John Mills perhaps when the next publication is out. And so thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tracy.